traumatic. I'll tell you our problem.
Left, you see. Kennedy said, well, what do you mean by space reality? I thought we were just going to land a man on the moon. The idea of the one flight was expressed to Webb.
I'll tell you my recollections on that. In the summer of 61.
The budget, you know, still had some years to keep.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but I don't exactly place this, but
right.
Let me tell you, in the summer of 61, I was one of two or three people that went over with Jim Webb when he gave one of these lengthy interviews at Business Week.
Yeah.
Which then, you know, I still get Business Week complimentary as a result, because I was over there. The questions were raised in this interview about, you know, is this a stunt? What's the real value of landing on the moon? But if you go back and read that issue, which appeared sometime in the summer of 61, I think you'll find very clearly that Jim had in mind very strongly, first, that we were really attempting to build a long-term large capability. But this was the underlying purpose. And secondly, that insofar as a race with the USSR was concerned, he didn't view it as a technological race, per se. He viewed it as a societal organization race. He said, look, we have something here that is so difficult that they can't pull it off the shelf and do it. They're going to have to develop the equivalent kinds of systems that we have. And therefore, we, in a sense, have a chance where we're not starting clear. They're not clear out of the chops yet. They may or may not be ahead of us, but when you get down to the elementals, they've got to do this terrific organizational task because it's a big job. And he said, what really is at play then is, can the democratic capitalistic system in the United States organize and produce itself better than the communist society? And he said, I think we can. And I said, I think that's the real test that we're testing here, is which society can organize the total range of resources that are required to pull off this job.
I suspect this is after Kennedy shook Webb.
Well, but this was in the summer of 61.
Yeah, he started this open campaign.
Yeah.
He started from scratch on this.
Yeah.
When he took the job, he said he wouldn't take it unless he was free to fight for the program. And he started out with this, but he accelerated and expanded it.
Well, you know, internally, Jim used to get boiling mad as... being responsible for the budget, I was also responsible for the books we sent up to Congress, you know, the congressional books. And I don't remember what period this was, but it was about 64, I would guess, maybe 63. The write-up on the Apollo program sorted off something to the effect that the objective of Apollo is to land man on the moon and return him safely to Earth. And we had the thing all ready to go up the hill, and Jim took a quick look, and that was the first chapter. Apollo program, and he hit the ceiling. He says, that is not the objective of the Apollo program. The objective of the Apollo program is to build a capability and to demonstrate it by landing men on the moon. And we had to pull the damn books back and rush and rewrite and reprint and everything else. He was livid because he said, haven't these guys, don't they understand yet what the purpose of this program is? It is not to land men on the moon. And as far as I know, Jim felt this right from the summer of 61 on. There was never any question in Jim's mind. We had I'm not sure when, and some elements, whether yet it has penetrated throughout the manned space flight organization, that there really is a difference, you know.
Is that around in your mind?
Yeah.
We certainly got hooked on it and are suffering because of it.
Mm-hmm. He was very, very clear on this point in his mind. And he tried, he thought he was articulating, this is why he got exasperated, is don't these guys understand yet? Yet being we were 3 or 4 years into the program, something like that. Now, you mentioned this, when the budget bureau began to, that doesn't ring a bell to me. The thing that rings a bell in the 1963-64 period, Margaret Chase Smith asked we'd talked about this program will cost in the range of $20 to $40 billion. And incidentally, my recollection is very clear on that one. That first started with Keith Glennon, not with Jim Webb. Some of the presentations that George Lowe made to Keith Glennon and George Kistikowski in the waning days of 1960 on the Apollo concept of a circumlunar flight as perhaps the next step that we ought to undertake in manned flight. So you got to remember that we were fighting to get some recognition into the budget, the last budget submitted by Eisenhower in January of 61, that'd be the 62 budget, that there would be some program beyond Mercury. And it was finally decided at the Eisenhower administration level that no, there would not be any commitment to any program until we had accomplished the Mercury objectives, is the way I think it roughly came phrased out. But we had been pushing that this was the time, from a timing viewpoint, that we had to look to what are we going to do next. And in about November or December of 1960, I remember George making a presentation to Glennon and George Kistikowski on concepts for lunar exploration and cost estimates of, now for his, he was estimating, as I recall, something like the order of $9 to $10 billion. And I remember Keith Glennon sort of snorting and saying, well, I haven't been in this business very long, but I've been in long enough to know if you say $9 to $10 billion, it's going to run $20 to $40 billion. I know that. And that's the first time this $20 to $40 billion phrase was used, to my knowledge. And then it was picked up by the president's speech. And we had an awful time, never did really satisfactorily figure out. Yeah, we never did satisfactorily figure out where did this president use it, whether he was talking about our cost estimate for the whole program for the whole decade. One of Abe Hyatt's layouts indicated that something in the $30 billion range. Is that what he was talking about, or what was he talking about? But anyway, he used a phrase, this will cost us up in the 30s, as I recall, $30 billion. Well, Webb, of course, was pretty astute, and when we did the first cost analyses of the whole Apollo program in the summer of 1961, Bill Fleming ran a study, we came up with something in the order of $11 or $12 billion. And Jim said, look, I've got to apply a discount. I don't know what it's going to cost, but I know it's going to cost something more than that, and I think we probably better talk in the range of $20 to $40 billion. That number has been used. And he used it, and then gradually he got around the point of saying, I think, you know, it's going to be on the low side. It'll be closer to 20 than it will to 40. And in 1963 or 64, and I don't remember the exact date, Margaret Chase Smith said, give me a little backup. You use this. What will go into the $20 billion? We had a hell of a time. My office did it to back up the $20 billion. We added up all the estimates that we had at that time, and they didn't come to $20 billion. So we began to throw in everything that we thought could be identified as part of the manned lunar Apollo program, as we throw in OSOs, because we were going to have to know whether or not there were sunspots flaring, and therefore we said we could really write that off as contributory. We threw in Ranger, Surveyor, and I don't remember whether the orbiter was in the program, but anyway, what was ever in the program at that time, I threw that all in as, well, this obviously contributes. We threw in all the RNPM estimates for the manned flight centers. We threw in all the construction, not only direct, but anything that we could remotely say, well, this will be also used. We had to do that to get it up to $19.7 billion. The only way we could get it up that big. At that time, I think the Apollo itself, as we now think of the Apollo project, R&D cost was, well, I don't remember, it was something like $14.7 billion. So we established that this was. Then she got in the habit of every year saying, will you update your estimates? And of course, every year the Apollo R&D cost kept going up, so we kept sort of throwing things out that said, well, you know, we really don't want to call it Mercury. Originally, we'd thrown Mercury in. We'd thrown Gemini in. You know, we don't really want to call that part of the Apollo costs. And so then we went through this period of trying to throw things out and still make it come out around $20 billion and do it in a fashion that didn't look too obvious. But this was the problem, is that no, we didn't have any hard estimates in that period that ran as much as $20 billion. Then, of course, when the bill finally came through, that, well, Webb's winning days, it was up around 21.7. Then we, incidentally, I had a knockdown, drag-out argument with Jim, because I said we ought to go up with pride and say, so we missed. We missed by 5%. Now, you know, you're going to hang us by our thumbs because it's going to turn out to be $21 billion instead of 20. And I think we ought to take credit for that. Nobody has ever run a project, you know, a hundredth of this size for a 5% cost overrun. And Jim would not hear to that. He said, no, we got to tell them that everything's a fault of Congress and not appropriating the monies that we requested. And, you know, back in 1964, that $600 million they cut, I said, Jim, we didn't make our initial estimates of what was in the $20 billion program until after Congress had cut that fiscal year 64 money out. And therefore, we cannot say it's your fault that the program costs up, because the first cost estimate we really pulled together for Margaret Chase Smith was after that. And I remember Jim turning on me and saying, shaking his finger at me and saying, don't ever tell me what I would have done or wouldn't have done with that $600 million. He says, I say that it's a cut. And that was the only year that Congress made any appreciable cut, in that one year. I say it's their fault, and that's the story we'll carry forth, is that the costs are up, and it's too bad.
Dryden made a very strong statement.
Yeah, well, Dryden.
Cut in the 60s.
Yeah. But the only really sizable cut in the program was in FY64, the only year. The rest of them were more or less token cuts. But Jim had something going. Ed and I never did understand it exactly. But he had something going with the hill that, by golly, he was going to pin this on the legislature. It wasn't anybody else's fault. And he wouldn't accept what I thought was a very reasonable position to say, let's go out and brag about how we're going to finish it for 5% over estimates. A very reasonable position. You know, I said cost of living, which we weren't runaway inflation in, but cost of living alone, I can show you, would result in at least a 5%, you know, in fact, 10-15% over a space of 7 or 8 years. And no, he wouldn't hear to any of that. You know, we had really a rather bitter exchange on that one.
More Saturn questions? Is it Saturn?
Frankly, on Saturn itself, as a project, I don't really have too many definite recollections.
We know something about the cost overrun on the S2, for example. Do you have anything to add to that?
No. No, it was a combination, of course, severe technical problems there on the insulation and on the welding and all that sort of thing. But also, and I don't know that I could prove this conclusively, but I know that part of the cost there is that we didn't realize in our cost estimating that we were buying S&ID. I mean, we were 100% customers of S&ID, and somebody got to pay the bill. Now you see, for a long time, and this would happen, if we had had some post-Apollo activity that we could have fed in at the right time, we wouldn't have had to increase the number of people, because we could have retained them for use when we flew the S2 stages. But in the meantime, we could have given them, say, space station modules or something like that to build, and charged them off that way. And that would have reduced markedly the costs that we ultimately had to charge to the S2 stage. This is what you get into. It's, yeah, but it takes some large number of people. And you can give them other work. And we were counting for a long time on, obviously, there would be some post-Apollo activities, and they would be picked up in a timely fashion. And so all this goes into it. Now, they did actually run into, of course, these very major technological problems. But my view, those were almost second order when it comes to cost considerations.
Anything of interest on Michoud and?
No, I don't. I don't recall anything about either one of those that I'm sure you're not got available to you in other forms. I don't recall anything terribly noteworthy about either of those.
You talked about the problem with the S-2 in terms of keeping the capability alive. The parallel that strikes me is Marshall's own in-house capability.
That's right.
Which strikes me would be a tremendous budgetary saving in all these kinds of things.
How do you mean by saving? What do you think about?
Okay, well, maybe I'm not phrasing it right, but there is a center that is an in-house facility. And in that case, it's very easy to use it.
Oh,
all kinds of
you're thinking of, for actually assembling or fabricating in place of a contractor, that sort of thing?
Well, possibly.
Well, they did this, of course, on prototype stages and this sort of thing, although Marshall denies that they ever were a fabricator arsenal. They said we're only an assembly. We never did fabricate. Yeah, and this was considered, but first off, Jim Webb said, look, we're never going to carry a program like this through unless it involves all elements of the country, geographically, and it's got to involve practically all the major aerospace companies. If we begin to do this in-house, any substantial piece of it, we're not going to be able to carry the support of the country for 8 or 9 years and at the cost levels. Now, we did feel that, yes, this could make some substantial reductions in costs. The second thing, however, is that we were very rose-colored glasses at that time, and we were talking about, gee, this thing's obviously going to build up to 10, 12, or more a year. And this was far out of any assembly test capability that Marshall had as such. Now, as it turned out, if, you know, at a one or two a year, yeah, I think Marshall probably could have assembled and checked out. And we probably could have saved a lot of what went into prime contract costs. But it's really kind of water over the dam because I think Jim was probably right that you couldn't sustain support. Or really what you'd do is you'd get guys sniping at your program after a few years if they didn't have a piece of the action. So you got to get a piece of the action spread as widely as you could and across a very broad segment of industry. That's the only way you're going to keep them from sniping at you and tearing you down. And I think it's very sound.
This is part of the overall contracting philosophy.
Yeah.
Spread the word around the various.
Yeah. Spread it around over the country and involve as many segments of the major industries as you could. Conscious effort, for example, to bring companies like GE in on the support contracts, because Jim wanted GE to be a part of the action. And not to be aloof and, you know, we don't really care which way the space program goes because we're not involved. This way you could bring them in and it was in their interest to support us.
Do you know if that was one of the reasons why IBM was brought in?
No, I don't. I have a hunch that IBM may have been more on straight technical grounds that you're building this IU and...
Fabrication assembly of the IU.
Yeah.
No,
but the on-board computer. No, I don't know about the IU. I that's a detail. I wouldn't have the slightest idea.
Getting them into Huntsville and getting to
no, it may have been part of it is that, okay, there's an opportunity to get them locked in very tightly, on the whole program so that they're integrally involved. I know this was Webb's general philosophy. I think it was very sound. If you're going to do something like this, you don't just look at it strictly from what's the cheapest way. You look at it, what is the way that's going to sustain it as well as, because... And incidentally, you know, not disregarding costs, if you run something like this for 3 or 4 years and then it falls because it doesn't have support, that's a very costly thing because you end up with nothing. So you can't really say that you're disregarding costs. It's one way of saying that it's such a complex thing to do that you've got to look beyond your first order cost estimates in order to understand what's involved.
Do you recall any other particular occasions or incidents? You know, headquarters management, maybe it's within headquarters, you know, manned space flight.
The only thing I recall that bears on this, and I'm sure you'll get ample on this, though, is when we had to pull the Centaur out. because with the management responsibility shifted from ARPA to Huntsville on the Centaur, Huntsville did not seem to be very keen about putting best talent on Centaur. They wanted to put their best talent, rather obviously, on the Saturns. And it finally reached a point where it was felt the decision had to be made. Let's get the Centaur out and put it into a center that would put its best talent. And Lewis was the other obvious center, being a proposing center. So we had to pull that out. But that was really the case. That you can't say Marshall was disinterested in Centaur, but their main interest was in Saturn, and they were putting all their best teams together around Saturn, and the feeling was that they weren't. And again, I'm not derogating the individuals that worked on Centaur, but they weren't giving them the management support. It wasn't the first priority task as far as headquarters was concerned. That's why it was finally pulled out. Again, Abe still felt that, the Centaur by that point was to be, as I recall, it still, even on a schedule basis, showed that it would be the first real demonstration of a hydrogen stage. Although I don't know, there may have been some schedules along about that time. It said the S-4B would be flying before the...
But Clobbered the Space Science Program, they required...
Well, it had a severe impact on the vehicles, but the thing that was involved there, I think, really was another factor. The Centaur was also started by ARPA, and it was also started without too specific an end use, a little bit like the S1 stage. And they loaded that with a requirement that it be capable of doing almost everything, two burns and this and that and everything else. And there was too much requirement for that stage of development. And when we got it, we were interested in it primarily for the Surveyor and the Mariner class escape missions. Did not have the same requirements on it for the synchronous traffic. And I think we suffered because we tried to put too much too early. Finally, we did, as I recall, simplify.
Plain technical problem.
Well, plain technical problem. These were compounded by the fact that we had to deal with the problems of insulating the tanks for XDX hours of coasting so that we could relight them up at synchronous altitude and all. And it just made a hell of a range of problems to load on the vehicle when the vehicle was still experimenting on the use of hydrogen.
I wish we'd get, but I don't think we'll ever get it. It ought to be done.
Yeah, there ought to be something done there on that Centaur. That was the reason, I think. There was technical difficulties, but the technical difficulties need not have been quite as much as they were, but because it wasn't a clean design goal to start with. It had too many goals. And gradually, ARPA kept shifting out. Of course, they came in with a Titan III, and then they kind of lost interest in the Centaur for their missions, and we were still trying to carry along a Centaur vehicle that in part was designed to meet their missions. And they finally backed out of and went over to Titan III to satisfy their missions. And finally, we did simplify the design of the...
And Centaur II was viewed by Convair as kind of a booster thing, or just an add-on thing for their Atlas. It was to bring the Atlas into a new kind of booster system.
Yeah. But I don't think there were any real, no real, as I recall, any terribly great problems arose because of that interface. No, the Atlas is still one of the best damn vehicles that's ever been designed in terms of structural weight and everything else. It's a terribly advanced vehicle, even by today's standards. And I don't recall that was a direct contributor too much. But the problem as it involved Saturn was that Marshall just felt that their responsibility was Saturn. They had inherited the Centaur. They were not going to be the mission managers for the missions that we're going to use Centaur, and they just didn't seem to feel that it had the priority that headquarters thought that it should have.
Kraft or Erica also said that Marshall was a very creative center and didn't like the idea of looking after somebody else's creative development.
Oh, I think this was part of it, not invented here. As I say, they inherited it just as a project. Here, the thing is pretty well cast in concrete to manage it. They're not unique in that. This is something you run into to almost every center, particularly, well, I don't know that I would single any of them out. I think they're all guilty of the same thing. You know, if it's your idea, you push it like hell. If it's somebody else's idea, you probably will try to change it until it's your idea before you push it.
That's interesting, because even with the development of the Centaur engines, there's a lot of stuff that came out of Lewis to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the engines and all, and of course the basic R&D work on hydrogen. But at that time, we were still suffering under the concept that was Hugh Dryden's as much as any, that we ought to keep a pristine line to protect the virginity of the research centers, and we shouldn't get them involved in any project development. Otherwise, they would put all their energies on running projects and stop doing research.
Long way from that now, aren't?
Yeah. Well, I think it's turned out in experience that it's actually been helpful to the centers to have projects, because it gives them a focus for their research. But Hugh was terribly worried that that everybody would desert the research side and want to go over and be project managers, and therefore the conscious policy of not assigning projects to the research centers. And this was perhaps the first reversal of that, where they said we've got to
get it.
But if
Lewis really wants to do it up there.
I don't recall. I wasn't involved, so I don't recall. I can tell you the only thing about that is I'd got to the point where I thought it was, and told Bob Siemens, I thought, you know, everybody ought to be thrown out of court. Finally got down to a hassle about some 6 or 12 positions, not people. Were they or were they not going to be taken off the Marshall list and added to, in other words, were the positions going to go with the task assignment, or was Cleveland going to have to find these from within the complement that they had already had? And this was only something like, it was either 6 or 12 people. And this came up, and there was a hell of a lot of agonizing and negotiation back and forth at Bob Siemens' level. And I said, look, you know, you ought to throw everybody out, starting with manned space flight and Marshall and Cleveland. If they can't solve, Cleveland's got 4,000 people. Marshall at that point had 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 people. If they can't find 6 to 12 slots, and this was when we were still somewhat growing, we hadn't yet reached any major decline in things. If they can't solve that, you get yourself another set of managers. The only answer is that hell, this should never get to you. So, it's ridiculous to be worrying that at the general manager's level about should we or shouldn't we transfer 6 slots. I don't recall people, though.
Well, it's electric propulsion area, you see.
Yeah, still in there, of course.
Trying to integrate the two efforts.
Yeah, but no, I don't know. You'd have to check with somebody.
Maybe on a political side to sort of break up the German set it was referred to.
I'm just not aware on that one.
Well, we have taken a good hour.
You'd have to check, right? I don't really offhand know that I have anything else to contribute or that I've contributed anything.
Perspective is very good.
No, it's very good, yeah.